We're going to start this morning with a little experiment. May not work. It'll be okay if it doesn't work, but we're going to try it. I want to hear from you. What messages do we get from our culture about love? Yeah. Shout it out. It's cheap. Love is all you need. What else? I heard sex. I heard it should make you happy. No comment. It's an emotion. What else?
Can't buy it.
You can't buy it, except on Valentine's Day. Kind of. Just coming. Love is a choice. You hear that from our culture? All right. Anything else? As I've been thinking about it this week, I think we live in a culture that's simultaneously obsessed with and disillusioned with love. On the surface, if you listen to pop music or pay attention to culture, it seems like love is still a big theme. It's hard to find a movie or TV show that doesn't have some sort of love interest or a will they or won't they kind of thing. But there's a recent article in the American Conservative that I've been looking at this week that points out that actually references to love in popular culture have gone way down. Think about how popular the rom-com, the romantic comedy was at one point. Now, when's the last time you saw a good old rom-com with a happy ending? In music, too, there's a lot of talk about sex, but a lot less about love. Much less the kind of love that lasts more than a night. Seems like the hookup has replaced the relationship. There's some statistics that indicate there's trends even in the millennial generation. Not to pick on millennials, but there's a lot of research about them right now, right? There's much less interest in love and relationships. They're the least likely to listen to love songs or watch love stories on the screen. This is a quote from that article I mentioned in the American Conservative. In a culture that runs on the fuel of instant gratification, love can look like too much effort. The phrase hookup is indicative of people who believe that romance should function like an electronic device. Plug it into a power source and press the on button. There's a similar article that was floating in my mind this week from Christianity Today, entitled Ease is the New Vice. Ease is the New Vice. And again, sorry, millennials, I'm pretty close to you. But there's research that about the most popular breakfast for millennials is not cereal because it's too much work to clean up. But for us Christians, too, I think we like things easy sometimes. I like Amazon. I like being able to get a book on my phone when I'm doing sermon preparation right then. You know, I like two-day shipping. That's free. Internet gets faster and faster. It's all about faster and faster. I think when it comes to love, too, we want love, but we want it to be easy. When we get to Paul's chapter from the Corinthians, can sound a little bit naive, a little irrelevant. We can think of it as the Bible version of a Hallmark card. It's the famous love chapter, which I'm sure everyone in here has heard at a wedding. I chose it for my own wedding. Some of my clergy friends complain about this passage getting used at wedding because it isn't really about romantic love, right? And yet the love that Paul describes is exactly the kind of love needed for a marriage to last, the kind of love that is not easy. It's the kind of love needed for a friendship or a church. This is not a Hallmark card. It's not about love in the abstract. It's not something meant to make the Corinthians feel warm and fuzzy. It's closer to the truth to imagine this chapter being read in the context of a tense church business meeting or a leaders' gathering. As you know, the church in Corinth had a lot of problems. Well, Paul's response in this chapter is to hold up a portrait of love that is designed to show them gently the ways they were falling far short of love. It's a deep challenge to the Corinthian church, and it's a challenge to the way our culture defines and devalues love. And more importantly for us today, it challenges us too. So this morning we're going to look at three challenges that Paul's portrait of love poses, I think, to us in this community. So first, Paul's portrait of love challenges us to be honest about our motivations. And I'm looking here at verses 1 to 3. The church in Corinth had all sorts of people with spirit-filled gifts like speaking in tongues and prophecy, these really spectacular things. They thought these gifts were superior, that exercising them made them superior to those who didn't have those gifts, sort of the super spiritual ones. And in the previous chapter, which we heard in the service last week, Paul talked about how everybody has gifts to offer in the body. No gift is unnecessary. Right before this chapter, Paul writes, they should eagerly desire the greater gifts, but he would show them the most excellent way. And then he turns what they think is excellent on its head in what we might call the math of love, which is that X minus love equals zero. Being excellent in languages or speaking in tongues without being exercised in love is just empty noise, like Ruthie banging on a cardboard box, which she does. Preaching and teaching, even with direct revelation from God, knowing deep things without love, gets you nowhere. Same thing if I could work miracles without love. If I could heal you right now without love, it gets me nowhere. If I were to sell everything I own and give it to the poor, if I were to rent out, you know, the Drake Hotel for the people who didn't have shelter this week in the cold, if I were to die as a martyr, saving many other lives, if done without love, it's no credit to me at all. Now, it might gain something for other people. Those people in the hotel rooms would be warm, and that's important. Paul's not saying there's no value in it at all, but just that it doesn't do me the credit I think it does if I do it without love. We can have all sorts of motivations for doing the things that we do. There's a character in the television show The Good Place, some of you might have seen that, who is a famous philanthropist, someone who in theory should be celebrated and praised for her goodness. But then it turns out she's really motivated by trying to earn her parents' approval, trying to outdo her sister. Without love, her good deeds profit her nothing. Sometimes we give for similar reasons, to be liked or praised, to be seen as good, to feel good about ourselves. Paul's words are a good challenge to us to be more honest with ourselves about why we do the things that we do. It's not that we wait till we can love perfectly to do stuff. You'd be waiting a long time, right? But sometimes we're just not as good as we think we are. At least I'm not. Second, Paul's portrait of love challenges our desire to disengage. We're going to look together here at verses 4 through 7. The church in Corinth had a particular set of problems. Competition with one another, some folks who were arrogant, had a sense of superiority, who wanted to exercise their rights and their gifts regardless of how others got trampled upon. So Paul wanted to restore order and to teach them how to treat one another with love, treat one another kindly. Their problems were, in a sense, a problem of too much energy and enthusiasm, or enthusiasm wrongly directed. Now, sometimes I think we get that sort of conflict in our community, people with a lot of energy. Sometimes it's me. But from what I've observed and from what I see and know to be true about myself, I think that when there's conflict or disagreement here at Church of the Redeemer, more often the opposite happens. We disengage. We withdraw and say nothing, at least not directly. Sometimes we leave. Many of us here are introverts. I am. Many of us here like to keep the peace. I do. When I get hurt, when I disagree, it feels so much easier to withdraw and disengage or just try to give myself time to get over it. Sometimes that's good. But sometimes that means never actually dealing with the problem at all. It's much easier to do that than to engage directly when I know it means conflict. But lack of conflict is not the same thing as the presence of love. Look at how active and engaged this next section on love is. All the words that Paul says love is or isn't are verbs, words of doing. Love is patient, meaning patient with people, not with circumstances. It's the opposite of short-tempered. Love is patient with the foibles of people who are different than me, who don't seem to get it, who just plain annoy me. None of you do that, don't worry. It's even, as one person writes, love is patient with people who have hurt you. And not just patient, but even kind. Love is kind. Kindness treats others gently. For as one commentator puts it, kindness recognizes that everyone carries a heavy load. Now, kindness is not the same thing as being nice. Jesus was kind, but Jesus was not always nice. He wasn't nice in the passage today that we read. Love doesn't envy, that is, get jealous of the gifts or blessings that other people have. Love doesn't boast or get puffed up, that is, brag about how much better you are or have it than others, internally or externally. Love doesn't have an inferiority or a superiority complex. In verse 8, love doesn't act inappropriately, calling the wrong kind of attention to yourself or doing what you want without any reference to how it affects others. Love doesn't seek its own. In other words, love doesn't insist on getting its own way all the time or get resentful when it doesn't. I love how one commentator puts the next phrase, love is not cantankerous. Sometimes I am, especially when I have lack of sleep, like at the moment. Love doesn't get irritated easily, even when the other person is being irritating. Karl Barth writes on this passage, love cannot alter the fact that my neighbor gets on my nerves, but it can rule out my allowing myself to be provoked by him. Not only is love not cantankerous, it also doesn't keep score of how it's been wronged or how long suffering it has been. Love doesn't say, I have put up with so much from you, look how good I am, or I put up with so much, now I can stop putting up with you. It's your turn to put up with me. Love does not embrace Schadenfreude, delight in other people's misfortunes. Nor does it call evil good. It rejoices with truth, even when that truth is hard truth about myself. These are words of engagement, words that are impossible to fulfill from a distance. Words that assume we are deeply embedded in one another's life, close enough that we will get annoyed by each other. Verse 7 raises the stakes even further. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. These are words of deep, deep commitment. These are words that say, I won't walk away when I get hurt. These are words that say, I won't give up on you. These are words that say, I will choose to be with you even when I don't like you, even when you misunderstand me, even when we disagree. Now, a side note, this is not addressing situations where there's abuse, marriage, relationship, community. Sometimes you need to leave. Even when there's not abuse, sometimes it's right to leave, but not just because it's hard. I think we need to be pushed a little bit to stay a lot of times. I do. We know we are called to love the people who are right in front of us. I don't think anybody would deny that in here. But it can be really tempting to, in the words of Jonathan Stormont, just keep changing who that person is standing right in front of us. I think Paul would have some strong words about that to us and to the church in our time. After all, Paul kept writing and writing and working with the church in Corinth, even with all their problems. He never gave up on them. The kind of love we're called to is a love that is a radical commitment to one another. To be with one another, to be for one another, to act and long for the good of the other, even if it's costly to me. That's the kind of love God shows us, after all. Now, this is extremely challenging, I'm sure, to you, to me. I like to be on my own. I think I'm pretty right a lot of the time, and it bothers me when other people don't agree. It's really tempting to just hang out with the people who get me, and ignore the people who don't, or dismiss them somehow, or blame them. That's easy to do. But that is not love. I like Brian Peterson's paragraph on this point. Paul never says that such love feels good. And this is where the typical use of this chapter goes off the rails. Such misunderstanding creates trouble not only for expectations regarding the day-to-day realities of marriage, but also for the realities of the church. Because of our disordered assumptions about what love actually is, we often act as though the mission of the church is to gather like-minded and likable people together. We think that in such a community, it will be easy for us to love, or more honestly, to feel the love. But true love is not measured by how good it makes us feel. In the context of 1 Corinthians, it would be better to say that the measure of love is its capacity for tension and disagreement without division. The measure of love as its capacity for tension and disagreement without division. And I might add, without walking away. The truth is that even in a community in which our gifts are exercised in love, some of us will feel hurt sometimes. That happens. There's a lot of talk about safe places these days, some mocking, some serious. Well, in the context of a church, I think a safe place is not a place in which no one ever gets hurt. That's impossible. But it's a place in which we try to create a culture of love. And when there is hurt, that we try to work through that hurt in love, honesty, and forgiveness. Can we commit to that kind of love together? A love that continues to engage even when it's hard. Third, Paul's words challenge our perspectives and our priorities. I'm looking here at the last part of the chapter. The church in Corinth thought that the spectacular gifts they were experiencing were a foretaste of heaven, heaven breaking through in some way. But Paul says, nope, in heaven we won't need those things. Speaking in tongues and prophecy have planned obsolescence, just like so many of the things we purchase these days. Your iPhone is not meant to last for 100 years. Neither are tongues and prophecy. Well, maybe 100 years. I don't know when Jesus is coming back. But love, love will last. Love is the sign of heaven breaking through. Love is the thing that will grow to maturity and fullness in us when we finally see the one who is love face to face. Now, it's really easy for us to get our perspective wrong, our priorities wrong, to either rely on or fight about things that are temporary or surfacey rather than things that will last. If I preach or teach an excellent sermon but have not love, no good. If we have excellent music but have not love, no good. If we have a great kids program but have not love, there's nothing lasting there. I found a rather pertinent story from a theologian at Calvin Seminary named Stan Mast, who writes this. A number of years ago, I was privileged to travel to Cuba to visit a tiny sister denomination, the Christian Reformed Church of Cuba. Under Castro's nose, this little band of Christians was thriving. In fact, they had just built a beautiful new church building. As Reverend Aurelio Martinez showed us through this yellow stucco, white-tiled edifice, we asked if this building would attract people to Christ. He said, no, it might get them here once or twice, but they won't come to Christ because of this building. I asked if the preaching of Christ would do it. He said, no, even that won't do it. They won't believe us unless we show them love. That will be true for us in Highwood as well. Now, our new building is going to be so, so great. I hope you've been able to see some of the pictures. I really believe it has the potential to empower our ministries in so many ways. And yet, absolutely no one will see Jesus, will find Jesus just through that building. Only a people who are radically committed to, for, and with one another. A people who look like Jesus. Only that can make a difference. That is where Jesus is revealed. We're in Epiphany where we're talking about that. That is where Jesus has been revealed. And if that sounds scary and hard, it is. It's both something we work to do and something we are powerless to do. Because remember, love is first and foremost a fruit of the Spirit, something the Spirit works in our lives. Just as the Spirit does with patience and kindness and faithfulness and self-control, all the other qualities the Corinthians lack, and we do too. It is the Spirit who works these things in our lives so that we exhibit the kind of love that looks like Jesus. So there's a lot of challenge here, but there's a lot of hope too. Hope that we can and will be transformed. Hope that we can be forgiven by God and one another when we fall short. Hope that the Spirit can make possible on our own power what would be impossible. Now, if you're like me, looking at this passage might both inspire you and make you sad. I know I've felt sad sometimes this week just thinking about the ways I fall short. It's easy to hear that passage this way, especially when I presented it as a challenge. And yet, Christ is being formed in me. And Christ is being formed in you. And Jesus is patient. Jesus is kind. Jesus does not envy or boast or is not proud. Jesus does not dishonor others or is self-seeking nor easily angered. He does not keep a record of wrongs. Jesus does not delight in evil but rejoices with the truth. Jesus always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Jesus never fails. May the God of love give us the strength to put aside our desire for ease for the good of one another. May he grant me and you the ability to engage even when we've been hurt, even when we disapprove. May he grant us perseverance when we want to give up, hope when we feel defeated, forgiveness when we fall short. And may we have faith and hope in the work of love our God is doing in our midst, and in me and in you. Amen.